Hello, everybody. Welcome back to season 3 of Better Than Bad. This is the film podcast where we take an actor or director's highest rated and lowest rated film and decide which one really is better. Today, I am joined by not one, but two special guests. It is returning guests, friends of the podcast, friends in life, Patrick and Taylor. How are you guys?
Hello. We're so happy to be here, as always.
Yes, very happy to be back. Always nice chatting with you and podcasting with you. We kind of swap appearances on each other's shows, and so you're the person we've podcasted with the most, so it's always nice talking to you.
Yeah, and I'm so happy that you guys agreed to come back and talk about another bad film. but we'll get into that in a little while. Do you want to tell everyone who we're going to be talking about today?
Yeah, sure. So we're going to talk about Robin Williams. I was thinking about this earlier. The backstory on this is kind of, Jess, you know, you were prepping for this new season of your show and you sent us kind of a long list of the people that you have thought of or are considering or what have you. And nobody was really jumping out at us. And if they were, their bad movie just seemed unbearable, or their bad movie is so obscure it's hard to find, which has happened to us in the past. And so we kind of just couldn't really, we kind of just mulled some stuff around and couldn't really come up with anything. And I don't know why Robin Williams occurred to me. I don't know what I was thinking or doing. I don't know where the thought came into my head. But as I kind of thought about it a little bit, I was like, you know, this I think is a really interesting conversation because he was such a beloved guy and well-loved and has such adoring fans that I think the conversation of how and where does a lowest rated movie come from is interesting. And also just a versatile performer, big comedies, small dramas. I think just a guy with a long career, a big range, tons of fans. And I just kind of felt like that would fuel a lot of our conversation. I kind of ran it by you guys and everybody thought it was a good idea. So here we are watching a Christmas movie in March.
I feel like Robin Williams is a person – I was kind of shocked when you said Robin Williams, but not shocked in a way that, like, what made you think of him? He's obscure, but he's the opposite. It just – you know, I feel like Robin Williams is one of those people who is very much a household name, not even necessarily because of his filmography directly, but just as a person, comic. I was thinking comedic and I was like, that's not right. As a comic, as just like a warm guy. And so when I was actually going through his Letterboxd, I realized I feel like I haven't seen many Robert Williams movies. And so that was kind of a shock to me. I feel like maybe I saw a bunch when I was a kid, or I just haven't revisited them, or I've seen bits and pieces of them. But I haven't really like sat down and dug through his filmography. So this was an interesting exercise for me.
Yeah, he's one of those actors that like everybody knows because he was like, I think, pivotal for people our age, our childhoods. But it was the set. He did so much. He was in so much that when you actually go and look at the filmography, you're like, oh, wow. Like, I haven't seen half of this because you only kind of know him for those bigger things. So this was actually quite an interesting one. Someone I hadn't actually thought of to, you know, talk about. But I actually think he's kind of the perfect person to talk about on this type of podcast, because usually what happens with these films, and funnily enough, it's not what's happened this time, but usually what happens is that their earlier stuff tends to be the lowest rated, and then it's the sort of newer stuff that gets the higher ratings. But there was a real mixed bag with his filmography, which I think is really interesting. So just obviously, I would imagine that everybody listening to this podcast knows who Robin Williams is, but just in case you don't, Robin Williams was an American actor and comedian. He was known for his improv skills and the wide variety of characters he created on the spur of the moment and portrayed on films, in dramas and comedies alike. He is regarded as one of the greatest comedians of all time. Robin began performing stand-up comedy in the mid-1970s, and he rose to fame playing the role of Mork in the ABC sitcom Mork and Mindy between 1978 to 1982, before landing his first leading role in the film Popeye in 1980. He went on to star in a number of films and won an Oscar for his work on Good Will Hunting. He died on August the 11th, 2014. So the films that we're going to be talking about today, We've got his highest rated film, which is Good Will Hunting, which came out in 1997. It has 8.3 stars on IMDb with a Rotten Tomatoes rating of 97%. And then we're also going to be talking about a film that has two titles, so you can pick whichever one you like. It's called A Merry Christmas Miracle in the UK at the very least, but also Merry Friggin' Christmas. We are talking about a Christmas movie in March. It's fine. We're just going to roll with it, guys. Don't worry. That came out in 2014 and it has 5.1 stars on IMDb with a 14% Rotten Tomato rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Hello. Just to note, though, his lowest film is actually... We went through a bunch of different lowest films. his lowest film is actually called Can I Do It Till I Need Glasses from 1977, which has 4.2 stars, but it's unavailable to watch anywhere. You cannot find it. I imagine there's a good reason you can't find it. And Merry Friggin' Christmas is actually tied at 5.1 stars with Club Paradise from 1986 and Toys from 1992. We were originally going to watch Toys, but in the UK, you cannot get hold of that film unless you buy a DVD at an extortionate price on Amazon. Whereas this one, Merry Christmas Miracle, Merry Friggin' Christmas, whatever you want to call it, was more readily available. So we went for that one. We're going to start off by talking about Good Will Hunting because we go in chronological order. So before I get into the spiel, had you guys seen Good Will Hunting before?
No, I think it was a first time watch for both of us. Surprising first time watch, but yeah, just a blind spot.
Yeah, I feel like this is a movie that you hear about, most people have watched, but I have heard about for a long time.
It kind of exists in the public consciousness.
Yeah, I think for some reason I was under the impression that its defining characteristic was that it was like an ungodly sad movie, which it's not. So that's like what has kept me from watching it. Like I was like, man, you don't just like sit down and go like, I'm going to put on Schindler's List. Like, you know, you have to kind of mentally prepare. And so I don't know what I was mixing that up with in my head, but I was pleasantly surprised that it wasn't depressing as hell.
I think because I'm the same. I hadn't seen it and I thought the same thing. I think we were mixing up with Dead Poets Society. I honestly think that that's what we were mixing up with. Or that's what I was mixing up with.
It could be A Beautiful Mind.
Could be as well. There's a lot of films.
No, because I've seen A Beautiful Mind a bunch. Oh, okay. So I know that.
I think this was one of those films that came out. There was a bunch of films that came out around the same time that all had a kind of similar themes. So I think that might be what it is. But yeah, I hadn't seen this before either. This is a first time watch for me. Good Will Hunting is a 1997 film directed by Gus Van Sant and written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. It stars Matt Damon, Robin Williams, Ben Affleck, Minnie Driver, and Stellan Skarsgård. It was nominated for 9 Oscars and won 2, one for Best Original Screenplay and one for Best Supporting Actor for Robin Williams. It's about Will Hunting, a janitor at MIT who has a gift for mathematics but needs help from a psychologist to find direction in his life. When I read the synopsis for this, I'm not going to lie, I read it and I thought, that sounds really boring. But I was pleasantly surprised by how much I actually enjoyed this.
I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here.
Oh, no. She's going to come on and say, Good Will Hunting stinks and Merry Friggin' Christmas is not as bad as everybody said.
Okay. Let me explain. No, I think that Good Will Hunting is very good. excuse me. I think it's a very strong movie. I just think I have to be honest. We watched this right after, like literally minutes after we watched Dead Poets Society. We just decided to have a Robin Williams day. And I feel like going from Dead Poets to Good Will Hunting, I went like, oh, how is Dead Poets not his highest rating? How is that not his highest rated film? Like, I can't understand a universe in which the masses believe that Good Will Hunting is a better movie than Dead Poets. Like, that's mind boggling to me. So it's not that I dislike Good Will Hunting, but I cannot sit here and say I agree that it is his best film.
I just feel like I was really impressed with the fact, I felt like the characters were all very realized and that it's quite a long film and it's the type of film that realistically could be very boring. You're sat there watching, it's a lot of dialogue. It's very much one of the, it, realistically, it could be a play. That's how I always kind of describe these types of films. It could be a play if it really wanted to be. And so it can be, it could, has the potential to be boring on screen, but I wasn't bored at any point. I was really engaged with it. And I don't know whether that was, I think part of that's the writing. I think a really big part of that is actually the acting. I think all of these actors really like embodied these characters and became these characters. And so I was sort of fully immersed and engrossed in what they were doing. So I really enjoyed, I came away from it thinking, wow, I actually enjoyed that so much more than I thought. Because I just went into it thinking I'm going to be bored. So I haven't seen Dead Poets Society, so I can't make that comparison, unfortunately. It's on my list. But I think it's one of those, it's sort of around that time where he had sort of quite similar roles. Robin Williams had those sort of like roles of teachers, or in this case, a therapist, just kind of leading people and giving them direction in life. But he does, I mean, he plays that very well. I thought his acting in this was stunning, personally.
I think it's really interesting because, and you kind of touched on this a little bit in your intro, Jess, that like people roughly our age, I think when you think of Robin Williams, you think of him as being in like family movies, in children's movies. I mean, you just like quickly rattle off the list. I mean, like obviously Aladdin is kind of the big one, but then you do, you know, somewhere around our age range, you've got Night at the Museum, Jumanji, Mrs. Doubtfire, Robots, Hook, another Night at the Museum movie, Flubber. So like, that's kind of what I think of. I think of kind of like the Disney kind of touchstone, that kind of thing.
He was like the A-list celebrity at your sleepovers. Yeah. Like I remember you were rattling those off and I was like, sleepover movie. Yeah. Sleepover. Yeah. Birthday party. Yeah. Sleepover movie.
But then you get like a little bit older and you watch movies that are older, more mature, and you realize that like his real bread and butter and like the thing that brought him, you know, all the critical acclaim and the hardware and stuff were these movies that had just that like kind of extra level of heart. I don't know if it's a Robin Williams quality and we can talk about that, but there is just kind of that, it's that kind of like adult drama with an oomph, you know. You've got the Dead Poets Society, the Goodwill Huntings, even Mrs. Doubtfire, you kind of realize when you get older, like that movie's very silly, but there's this heart to it. There's this message to it. The Birdcage, same thing, very silly, but it's got that message to it. Patch Adams, The Fisher King. And so you kind of start to go like, oh, this is the thing. Like people thought he was funny and he was a comic and he played the Met. And, you know, like he had all these great, comic highs. But I think the thing that kind of really cut through for people and really got to kind of the emotional core was stuff like this. And you see him in Good Will Hunting, and you know we're going to show up about Dead Poets. But same thing in Dead Poets Society, you can kind of see like, oh well, people grew up with him; they saw him on the sitcoms, or they saw him in some of these movies, or whatever it may be. And then you grow up and he's like literally a father figure in these movies. He is, he's someone that people look up to. He's a mentor, even like Night at the Museum. I remember he plays Teddy Roosevelt and he's like the mentor character to the Ben Stiller character, you know? So like, I think that's kind of why we have this image of him in our heads. It's like, we are the perfect age for that growing up with his career.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of those actors that I feel like he had this ability to really like become these different characters. And whenever it's very strange because he's got a very distinctive voice, a very distinctive style of, particularly in his comedy work. But when you watch him, I never watch a film with him in it and go, oh, I'm watching Robin Williams. I'm just like, oh, that's whatever character he's playing, which sounds like a really basic thing. But I feel that there are some actors where I do watch their stuff and I go, oh, I'm watching whoever it is. Like I'm watching this famous person play this part. But for him, every role that I've seen him in, and obviously as we touched on before, like there's a lot that I've sort of missed out on, but everything that I've seen him in, like he really just embodies whatever it is that he's playing. He has this really gorgeous quality with his acting, where you just kind of, everything that he does sort of has a real clear motivation, and it comes across so well on screen. And I found this really interesting. This was because I remember the first time I watched him in like a serious role, quote unquote serious role. He was in a film, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head. I think it's called like 1 Hour Photo or something, where he plays this weird, like slightly psychotic guy.
Yes, it's 1 Hour Photo, which is a great
and I
movie.
Remember watching that, and I don't know why I watched it. I bought the DVD at like HMV in the UK, just like, I'm just gonna get that, when I was just going through a phase of buying random DVDs. And I watched it and I was like, oh wow, that's Robin Williams. That's really weird. Like, I've never seen him in a role like this. And he absolutely nails it. And I was just like what a gift to be able to do such a broad range of things. And I mean, a lot of people always say, like, if you can do comedy, you can do drama. But if you can do drama, you can't necessarily do comedy. And whether you believe that to be true or not is up to you, but I think that he's a prime example of someone who really could do it all. And I thought what was really nice about the performance in this particular film is that it's so understated, and he's literally just having a conversation, but there's so much life within it and so much going on under the surface that I'm not surprised he won the Oscar for this, because it just, I think it's a real prime example of just how good his acting could be.
I think that's so interesting that you use that example, because number one, 1 Hour Photo is a great movie that nobody has seen, and he's like very chilling in it. He does the same thing in your favorite director, T. Christopher Nolan's Insomnia. He's really great in that movie, also doing a very similar thing. I did a couple things like in preparation of coming on your show, and one thing I did is I watched the documentary Robbie Williams, Come Inside My Mind, and in that, the director of 1 Hour Photo, which is so funny that you mentioned that movie, talks about how in between takes, he would have to riff. He would have to make the crew laugh. He would have to like go back to being Robin Williams, because like that was the thing that fueled his like creative juices. And he said he tried to kind of shut it down for a day because the movie is supposed to play a creepy, you know, kind of perverted guy. And, you know, he tried to kind of tone down the Robin Williams of it all. But then he realized, like, that's where the magic came from. That's where he found things. That's where he got creative energy. Mm-hmm. That's where he, like, he needed to, like, center himself. He said, and every time they were ready for another take, he would bring it back down and he would be ready for it again. That's just, like, how he worked. And it is so funny, because the other thing that I did was I watched his appearance on Inside the Actor's Studio, which, I just a quick aside, it is a travesty that show is impossible to find now. I had to sail the seven seas for that one. And he talks about doing the same thing for Good Will Hunting, that he just had to like constantly riff, and like, you know, he said they did a lot of late nights on that movie. He's like constantly just like hanging out with the crew and trying to make the crew laugh and stuff, because like that was what he needed to get through long days, and hopefully try and get other people through long days. And so yeah, I think that's number one, just so funny that you brought up those two examples, but also I think kind of at the core of what this is like, yeah, that comedy thing was like, that was the thing that fueled him as an artist. And that was where, I mean, you watch some of his stand-up and you watch some of his improv, and I mean, just unbelievably lightning quick. And it's that kind of energy and that kind of speed and that kind of like focus that he could also bring to some of the more dramatic stuff, so that even when that stuff isn't rapid fire in your face, it still has that kind of like pointed, direct, you want to go to like acting 101, objective, super objective quality to it. Like, he's always dialed in.
I think, okay, I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent, but I promise that I'm connecting it to Robin. So I'm a marketer. I specifically work in marketing theater. And something that we talk about a lot in terms of our marketing strategy is the phrase, your ordinary is their extraordinary. And it's like it's a really like simple phrase, but it's really true for the work that I do. We, you know, you might know everything that goes on behind the scenes at a theater, but the people following you online might not. So literally, your ordinary is their extraordinary. And this phrase kept popping up when I kept reflecting on Robin Williams and his performances in these movies. Because when you break down his performances, his brilliance is almost imperceptible. You can't really say that he's doing anything big or different necessarily, but he masters the basics in a way that is so distinctly him. And so when you're talking about like objective and like literally like being reactionary, you know, like he is acting against these other people's, oh my God, I can't speak. He's reacting against other people in a way that is so like inhabiting of this character, like you were saying, Jess. And like those are all technically acting 101 things, but they're also extremely difficult to master. There's a reason that, you know, actors and everybody, you could argue, but actors are always working towards being better because the sky is basically limitless in terms of what you can do with these foundational principles about acting. And he was just able to like completely hone in on all of those foundational things and make it masterful. I hope that made sense, but it makes sense in my head.
No, it is true. I think the quality that he had was that he was a really giving actor. This is something that when I go to my acting classes, they talk about a lot, is this idea of like just sort of being present with the other person and how that's actually a really hard thing to do because a lot of the time we're in our own heads when we're acting and we're just like thinking about what we're doing and what we look like and all of that and how you're being perceived. And this whole idea of just like letting that go and really trusting yourself and trusting the other actor that you're with. And he did that, and I could see that in this film. Like he was just giving all of himself to whoever he was working with in that scene, was completely present, completely where he needed to be, and then listening and responding. And it sounds like such a simple thing when you say it out loud, you listen and respond, but for some reason it's one of the things that I think a lot of actors struggle with, and I know that I've struggled with in my own acting like journey, is being able to just like trust that I can just sit, listen to the other person, and obviously you've got to know your lines, but say the lines back, and then whatever you've heard will inform the performance. And I just think that he had that ability like tenfold, and I could just see it in this film. And I actually think that obviously the other actors all had that as well, but I think in the scenes that Matt Damon and Robin Williams had together, I think it really elevated Matt Damon's performance as well, because sometimes when you're an actor, if you're with someone else who is like giving you all of that, it just elevates what you're doing. And I feel like in those scenes, it really brought out something in Matt Damon's performance as well, which I just think proves that he was just a really giving actor.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to keep using this kind of like acting class metaphor, because again, I really want to just like hone in on the fact that I think he's so good at like these, again, foundational principles. But I feel like when you're in, okay, no shade to Patrick and I's college acting teacher, okay? But
lots of shade to this teacher.
I loved her personally. But anyways, you know, when you have a scene, for example, and your character says like the same thing three times in a row, you go like, how is it different each time? How is it, you know, how can you inflect differently because your motive has changed? And like, there's merit to that. I'm not saying that there's not merit to that. But I think that there's something truly extraordinary in the way that when Robin Williams is presented with a script where an entire page is, it's not your fault, repeatedly, he doesn't actually go...
I literally did that exercise in an acting class.
He does not, like, go above and beyond to, like, inflect differently or make it different, because it's not about... It's about Matt Damon's character, who I'm blanking on the name on, Will. Sorry. It's about Will hearing it. So like that is the intention. The intention is to be so nonstop about it that Will actually hears it. And then there are changes to inflection, because once it's registered in Will's consciousness, now we can get creative with what exactly that means. What does it mean for it to not be your fault? But I feel like, you know, he goes that like extra mile with everything he does without being flashy about it, which I feel like is so atypical for such a big comic actor, but he just is able to tap into this other side of himself that's really, really impressive.
I do think there's some of that Juilliard to it, right? Went to Juilliard and got dropped, which I find really interesting. But I think that there's definitely like in one of the questions. So Inside the Actor's Studio, if anybody hasn't seen, I can't, you know, I think there are people now who don't know what Inside the Actor's Studio is. It's a show that used to be on TV where a famous actor would go to the school, the actor's studio, and they would speak to the students. They'd do it for like 3, 4, 5, 6 hours sometimes. And then it would kind of get edited down to like a 90-minute thing. It was like questions about their life, and the students would ask them questions and what have you. And at the end, one of the students asked them the question, how are you so brave just riffing like that? They're specifically talking about his comedy. And he was like, I don't know what you mean brave. Like, that's not, I just do it. Like, it just comes to me. And he kind of explains that, like, people just have things that they're good at naturally. And trying things and not being afraid to be embarrassed and not being afraid to bomb and not being afraid to need another take is just a thing that I have. It's just a natural thing in me. Some people have that. Some people don't. And I think that, to your point, T, like there was probably a lot, and Matt Damon, I like Matt Damon a lot, and I'll get a chance a little bit later, maybe just let me goob on baby Matt Damon just a little bit, but he's young, he's a baby, and it's his, you know, first real movie, and it's his script, and like, you know that Matt Damon needed takes. I don't know how much Robin Williams needed takes and more utilized takes. And if they were going to be there, he was going to do his thing, you know, whether that's, you know, that comedic or not thing, just that riff, that ability to change and react, I think, is definitely kind of at the core of it all.
And I think it's so interesting that you said that and you explained it like you did, which I know is taking it from Inside the Actor's Studio, because that is how Will explains his genius. Like, he sits down with Skylar and she goes like, I'm working really hard. I know that it's like fun for you to do my organic chemistry homework because it's easy, but like, I do need to learn this because I don't just naturally know it. I need to put work in. And, you know, she says, do you have a photographic memory? And he goes, no, it's not like that. It just, you know, some people are good at whatever. And he says like some, you know, he was like, I couldn't hit a baseball, you know, if you dropped me in Fenway Park. If you dropped me in Fenway Park, I couldn't hit a baseball. But he says, when it came to science and these kinds of – and math, like, it just comes to me. And clearly, Robin Williams is a person whose comedy, whose – I hate using this word because I feel like it's so Gen Z of me, but bear with me. His vibe, like, those all come naturally to him. There are some types of performances, there are some types of acting styles, there are some types of like energies that like cannot be trained or even untrained out of people. Like, it is just so them, and I feel like he's one of those people.
It's all of that, isn't it? It's just all of this kind of like, you could call it genius, you could call it natural ability, whatever you want to call it. Like, he just had this lack of fear, I think is what it is mainly, to just do the thing, and if it doesn't land, it doesn't land. And I think that's something that a lot of people find really hard. And I just think it shows so beautifully in this film. In terms of the actual film, we should probably talk a bit more about that. So obviously I said that I enjoyed it quite a lot, but I'm interested to hear more in depth, like, your thoughts on this and the writing. And obviously it's written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. Their performances, like...
Yeah, Good Will Hunting. Good movie, terrible title. It doesn't make any sense, and it's a bad name, I think, for the character, and it's really just the worst mistake that they made.
There's a great Letterboxd review that was like all the different ways this title could be read and like breaks it down.
Where does the comma go? Yeah, is there a question mark?
Yeah, and it's like, it's like, Good Will Hunting? Like, you know, do you want to go hunting later? Will? Goodwill?
Goodwill?
Yeah, like, I don't know. Like,
Goodwill Hunting. Like, he's like a dog.
I read it like, yeah. Goodwill. Like, Goodwill was the first part, and then there was a comma in Hunting. That's how I read it. And then when it was like, his name's Will Hunting, I was like, oh. Oh, it's like, because he's a good, okay.
Like, that title's terrible then.
Yeah.
Really?
What I've deduced personally of the title is it's, you know, like, you're a good man, Charlie Brown, like, good, like, Good Will Hunting. Like, okay, we have established that Will Hunting is good. However, there is some sort of, like, goodwill. Like, yeah. There is, like, clearly an ode to Goodwill. Entendre. Definitely a double entendre. But I also feel like, does he have much Goodwill?
He's just kind of, like, kind of a little bit of a dickwad Will Hunting.
Yeah. He's kind of, like, bad Will Hunting sometimes. He's smart Will Hunting, capable Will Hunting, but bad Will Hunting?
Oh, my God. Okay. So the movie... Matt and Ben,
look like they have two brain cells between the two of them. No offense.
They've come out. This is their first movie, right? I mean, anything. They come out so fully formed. Like, both of them are so... You watch
The Martian and you're like, uh-huh. And then you watch The Town and you go, yeah, uh-huh.
Like, that, just that, like, Southy, you know, like, they, that, you know, kind of Boston hooligan thing. They come out so that, I mean, Affleck especially. I mean, Matt Damon will kind of does the leading man thing from time to time. You know, he'll do Talented Mr. Ripley or whatever. He'll do some riffing in The Martian. Affleck is just so painfully Affleck right away.
It was so funny. I mean, this is not a funny part of the movie. I'm just going to make a joke because I thought it was funny. When they have that genuinely, I think, tender moment where Ben Affleck, you know, looks at Will and he says, like, you don't owe it to yourself to leave here, but you owe it to us, because it's a slap in the face when you you're just going to decide to throw your life away when any of us would kill, literally kill, to have a quarter of the talent and the brains that you have, whatever. I thought it was so funny because he's like, you know, I want you to get out of here, man. I want you to get out of here. And I'm like, Ben Affleck, you literally cosplay as someone still stuck in Southie. Like, you call the paparazzi on yourself looking disheveled, chained, smoking cigarettes and drinking Dunkin' Donuts as if you don't live in a giant California mansion. Like, you're cosplaying as the poor.
Oh my God.
It's just, I don't know. Time changes, I guess.
Oh my God, that is funny. Yeah, the Boston of it all is very funny. I like that they're always worried about, like, coffee and food and beating the shit out of other guys. It's fun. It's very, like, it is the script, and I mean this in a sincere way, as well as kind of a joking way. It is the script that, like, two guys in their 20s write for themselves to be a Best Picture nominee. Like, it is.
I think that's what blows my mind, is you say that, and okay, sure. But how can these two idiots, for lack of a better term, who obviously are very talented, okay? But just bear with me here. How do these two idiots go, like, yep, we're going to be a Best Picture nom? Like, you already know it. Like, and to just, like, drop the mic like that and be like, we don't need to write anything ever again. We're actors.
Oh, they write The Last Duel. Yeah, I mean, listen, we don't need to get into the Weinstein of it all. But it's definitely like, okay, you'll play the lead. And then we'll...
Very generous of Ben Affleck, by the way. I would love to know the backroom deal. And by that, I mean the dorm room deal that these two boys had. To be like, okay, I am giving you the opportunity of a lifetime,
no,
Matt.
I think,
okay?
No. I think it's the opposite. I think Affleck knew his lane immediately. He was like, I'm going to come in here. I'm going to goob this joint up.
Sure, but I can't believe that this person, Ben Affleck, the guy literally smoking a cigarette outside of Dunkin' looking like he's just, like, you know, seen a ghost. I can't believe that guy was like, put me in more. Like, I need more scenes. Like, I just feel like I was like, good for him that he was like, I'm not going to sacrifice the art of this movie by imposing myself where I don't need to be. I'm just going to, like, nail what I did. Because if I were a 19-year-old or however old they were acting, you know, person who wanted to be an actor, I think I'd be a little more selfish. I'd be like, okay, big guy, you get this tender moment with Robin Williams. Where can we fit me? Who do I get to play against?
He knew it, though. He knew his lane. He knew his lane right away, which was, I'm going to goob it up until the end, and then I'm going to have maybe the best scene in the movie where he gives the monologue. They pegged themselves right away, is what I'm saying.
Good for them. I'm just saying, I don't know if I would have been so kind.
Anyway, Jess, we've taken over your show. You go ahead.
No, I am actually in mostly agreement with you. It was kind of really weird to me when I saw that they had written it, because when I see them both, they are just like lads, whenever they're like together. And I just thought, how bizarre that they went, let's just write this film together, and that this is what they came up with. Like, I wouldn't have expected this to come out of their brains. And as much as I enjoyed it, it is definitely one of those films where it's like, we're gonna write this, and the industry's gonna love it. Like, they're gonna love it because it's got all those themes that the industry loves. And it's definitely like ticking some boxes. That being said, I still really enjoyed it. So like, it clearly did something right. But yeah, it was just so bizarre. When I think of Ben Affleck in particular, I just think of that meme of him outside of his house with his cigarette, just looking disheveled and annoyed at life. So to see him write something like this is just, it was like, where'd this come from? You know?
No, that's what I'm saying though, man, is like he saw the future for himself and he knew that he was going to grow into that, and good for him. And he knew where, if he was not trying to make movies and if he was just a guy stuck in Southie, he saw how the course of that guy's life could turn into the Matt Damon or the Ben Affleck meme. And that's what he nails. He nails it. Casey comes in. He's such an idiot the entire movie. And then he comes in, you know, they do think spoilers for this movie, and you know, skip ahead 10 seconds. You know, he finally goes up to the porch and Will's not there, and Affleck's like, ah, you bastard. And he goes back down in the car and he goes, guys, he's gone. And the only thing that happens is Casey runs out of the car and jumps in the shotgun.
Yeah,
he's so happy he gets the shotgun scene.
I like, yeah, like the poor other guy, he's like, nope, I know I'm next in the hierarchy.
That's what I thought. I was like, he leapt out of that car. He didn't take a second of like remorse to be like, oh, my friend's gone. Leapt out of the car and he was like, it's my time. And straight into the other seat. I was like, wow.
Really does.
Wow. This is all he cared about. So weird. But no, I do like want to say that I really did enjoy this film so much more than I thought. Yeah, it's just so funny when you like put all the things together of like what we know and who we know, and then they've come up with this film. Do you think this is the type of film that you would watch again, or is this something that's like a one and done?
I'm not gonna say that I would never watch it again, but I do feel like there are maybe,
if cable still existed, we would watch it all the time because it's just like a TNT programmer.
Big hit for them week after week. Yeah, I feel like for me, it's just like, I do think that, and I'm not even necessarily talking about Dead Poets Society, although I think you could make the argument for that movie, but I just feel like that there are other movies that I think more successfully capture this theme. And I feel like, you know, it is like a treat to watch. Like, it's a treat to watch, you know, these like baby superstars, like really acting their ass off against huge titans who are not doing much. And I mean, they are doing a lot, and but they are like Patrick said, utilizing and not like wasting.
Stellan Skarsgård is so good in this movie.
He's very, very good.
He's like the dark horse of the movie.
I was going to say, I don't feel like he gets quite enough like representation, because you go like, oh, Ben and then Matt and then, or not in that order, but you know, and then Robin, and then yeah, he's really, really fantastic. And Skylar, I think, is actually really good as well. So I think it's a treat to watch, but I don't know if I wanted something of this like vibe and like theme if I would go to this movie.
Yeah, I feel it's a very good movie, and it's a terrible title. But I feel like there was definitely, it gave me like acting class flashbacks. There's a lot of like I said, and I mean this sincerely in a respectful way, but I also just mean it in kind of a goofy way of like, you can see these guys like taking what they've learned in their acting class and putting it down on a piece of paper and writing something for themselves because they can't get anything else off the ground. You know, Affleck had done that one, Kevin, I think he did Mallrats already, and I don't know if Damon had done anything, but it's very much like, I know I have this skill. Let me write this thing for myself. And that's great. And that's kind of amazing. I think that it's because it's been 25 years plus and we know them as their, you know, celebrity personas now. I do really get a kick out of them knowing what they can do and like writing a thing to showcase that and being like 25 and total dorks and winning an Oscar and being like, what the hell is going on in my life? But it's definitely very much like, you know, grad student-y, you know, we're going to do a lot of acting from their part, at least. I think Robin's great. I think he, you know, he's always great. It's definitely like, yeah, I don't know. I hate to keep bringing it up, but if someone put down Good Will Hunting and Dead Poets Society, or, you know, maybe even some of these other titles in front of me, I don't know if I would reach for Good Will Hunting, but like, I will see it again. Like I said, we don't have cable. Cable does not exist anymore, but like, I'm sure this played on AMC, like in between Shawshank and, you know, The Green Mile, like all the time back in the day. It's definitely like that kind of programmer. But there's a certain like, warm and fuzzy feeling to that kind of movie as well, that cable movie. So like, there are definitely things that I really like about it. I just don't know how much I'm going to reach for it.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same mindset. I think I would watch this again because I really did enjoy it, but it's not necessarily something that I'd be like, okay, I have to watch this again immediately. Like, if it popped up and it was on TV, like, you know, I do feel like it's that type of film that you know, I'll go home to my parents' house and I'll be scrolling through the movie channels, and then it will just like pop up and it'll be halfway through and I'll watch the rest. You know, that's the type of film that it feels like it is. But yeah, I think it is. Like I said, I just enjoyed this so much more than I thought I would. And yeah, like, good on them. That's my final thought. Good on them.
One thing that I think is interesting is obviously the big moment between Robin and Matt is the thing that you mentioned, it's not your fault. But otherwise, this is just my personal feeling, all of the best, and this is a testament to the writing, I think all the best scenes in the movie are about the other characters or their relationship to the other characters. I think Robin's scene with Stellan Skarsgård, where they kind of go back and forth about trying to get Will a job, I think is a really great scene. Affleck does the spiel about you got to get out of here, I'm going to kill you. That's a great scene. He's got a lot of great scenes with Minnie Driver. Like, I feel like it's like, you had that iconography of the poster in your mind of those two guys sitting on the bench, and it feels like their movie. But like, it's really a movie populated with like relationships, and you know you get all the way down to Casey Affleck, you know, or mm-hmm. or you learn so much about Ben Affleck's character when he goes and he gets the $73 or whatever for the retainer. Like, you really know everybody in a movie that's kind of pitched as a two-hander.
Yeah, I also just feel like, in terms of like a testament to the writing, again, there are really powerful dramatic moments. I'm not trying to take that away from this film, but I actually feel like the places where the writing excels the most are those really quick back and forth, like in the bar and he's telling him what's up, and you know, when they're, you know, just shooting the shit, because that is what it feels like, exceptionally conversational. It feels very authentic. Like, I feel like sometimes, even if you are drawing from real life inspiration, dialogue is hard. Dialogue is like really, really hard to write, because if you're not just speaking it out loud, which is natural, it's going to then be unnatural, even if you are drawing from things in your life or conversations that you have had before. But this feels so deeply authentic. And I do think in some of those dramatic moments, yeah, you can go like, okay, I can see how they pulled inspiration from this thing, or they got this note from their acting teacher and they want to make sure they fit it in, and they're kind of checking their P's and Q's. But I really feel like the writing like really excels in just those kind of like off the cuff moments with those ensemble of characters who I'm not even going to name because I don't know who they are. But like, again, the guy in the bar that just, you know, starts talking shit. The Harvard student that starts talking shit on Matt. Like, those are like really powerful moments and also really powerful performances, I think.
Yeah. I think it's just really fleshed
out.
Yeah,
I completely agree. The relationships in this film are really like well thought out. And I think that's what helps elevate so much of the performances, because it's just so clear where these relationships are. And I think that will only help the actors like get out those performances. So yeah, I completely agree with you on all of that. We're going to move on to our next film. So as I said before, it has technically two titles, A Merry Friggin' Christmas, also known as A Merry Christmas Miracle. So this came out in 2014. It's an American black comedy film directed by Tristram Shapiro and written by Phil Johnston. The film stars an ensemble cast featuring John McHale, Lauren Graham, Clark Duke, Oliver Platt, and obviously Robin Williams. The film was released by Phase 4 Films on November 7th, 2014. The film received generally negative reviews from the critics. It is about a guy called Boyd Mitchell and his family who must spend their Christmas with his estranged family of misfits upon realizing that he left all of his son's gifts at home. He hits the road with his dad in an attempt to make the 8-hour round trip before sunrise. Had you seen this before, or was this a brand new watch for you?
So yeah, I know that I've seen it, and this is Taylor's pre-Letterboxd days, and I didn't tag it with Taylor, which I used to do and still do. But so I think maybe you kind of were like around while I was watching it, but I watched it a couple Christmases ago. It was when we were watching Community, and it was like the Joel McHale
thing. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I feel like as soon as it started, I went like, I've seen this before, but I don't know if I watched the whole thing. Maybe I just was kind of like, again, in the room and kind of doing my own thing, but I definitely seen it. Like, it was vaguely familiar to me, but, you know, not quite a first time watch, but not quite a first time watch.
Yeah, I'd never seen this before. I'd never even heard of it before. So this was a first time watch for me. While I was watching it, I didn't write any notes down. My general consensus of this film is that it's kind of, it's just all right. Like, it's middle of the road. It's a bog standard Christmas film. I don't think there's nothing offensive about it. I wasn't there going, this is so awful. Turn this off now. I was like, it's just a bog standard Christmas movie. So yeah, nothing offensive, but nothing like overwhelmingly amazing either.
Okay, hold on. I'm sorry. Quick pause. I wonder if Jess has a different cut of the movie.
Because, yeah, I was going to say, ours was pretty offensive.
Ours was pretty raunchy.
Ours was pretty offensive and pretty outdated in the language it used, if you catch my drift.
Yeah.
To be honest, I did watch this a few weeks ago, and I've been so busy, I might have, like, erased some of it from my mind. I don't remember.
No, I think we're onto something that there are different cuts of the movie, because, like, it's the defining quality of the movie that we saw is that it is much more of like a 2003 movie than a 2014
movie.
Yeah,
like it feels outdated for 2014 in terms of the language it uses.
Oh, interesting.
And with the title change, I wonder if it's like two different movies.
I would, yeah, because I would not consider this bog standard by our American
standards. It's like racist. It's like sexist. They use the R word pretty casually. Yeah. So, yeah, I think maybe we got two different movies.
Maybe. I do think that slur was thrown around at one point in the film by Robin Williams. Okay. But I don't remember being like, oh, wow, this is outrageously offensive. So maybe we did. I mean,
no, it's never like turn it off. I'm not gonna don't get me wrong, but there's definitely a number in the movie that we saw, which I'd be interested to do the research here. It was definitely a number of like, even in 2014, I don't know.
Yeah, like I recently rewatched Mean Girls and I went, oh, it was made in 2004. That's right. Yeah. I forgot about that. We spoke differently in 2004. But I still love Mean Girls. I'm not gonna turn it off. But yeah, I would say, you know, this movie feels distinctly American. I can't even believe that it got like a UK release, because like, what does the UK want with this movie? It's Joel McHale and Lauren Graham. Like, I feel like that is like if AI generated a like 2014, but like C-list American low budget Christmas movie, like this is what it was. So I can't believe that there would ever be a UK audience to this.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, like, I didn't have any connection to it. Like, when you say, how did it get a UK release? I was like, this is...
They didn't ask you, so...
Yeah, they didn't ask me, but it's like, it didn't really land with me in terms of, like, any comedy or stuff. It did feel very American, but then I don't know whether you guys even found it funny, so I might just be generalizing there. But, I definitely didn't land for me as a UK person.
Are drunk Santas a thing in the UK? That's an ongoing trope in America, that like mall Santas and like Santas in general like are just like sleaze bags who are always alcoholics. Like, is that just like a trope in the UK, or do you generally trust your kind, generous mall Santas?
I mean, to be honest, like the shopping mall Santa isn't really a big thing over here.
Oh, really? No, every mall, dingy or large, has a mall Santa.
It's huge, and like the
we
the,
had like
our pet, like our pet stores have pet Santas. Like yeah. It's a huge deal.
Yeah,
we have like there's a couple of places that you can go to there's like gardening stores where you could go and they do stuff what? Like that, but they're not like in shopping malls or anything like that. Like you have to go to we have like Santa's Wait, grotto what? We have like Santa's grotto and you can go and like have like pictures with Santa there, but they're not like in a shopping mall, just in a random shop like, hey kid.
Wait,
whoa. So you never little Jess, your mom never took you to the shopping mall and you waited in line for 2 hours to see Santa and then they would like big flash bulb you a picture and you would buy, you know, 9 wallet sized pictures to give to your grandparents
and, like,
on Christmas.
5x8.
Yeah. You never did that?
And you were like probably crying in the photo because Santa's a freak.
Not in a shopping mall. No.
Oh my God. I did it
we
every
had it with the Easter bunny. Like we did a Black Friday sale or like a Black Friday sale at our local baseball park.
And the mascot was baseball
Santa.
Or it was baseball Santa.
He was like Oriole Bird Santa. Like like it's a huge thing. And so now my gears are turning and I'm going like, oh, of course all of our Santas are like alcoholic weirdos and like borderline pedophiles because we need so many of them.
You need like 50, like, you know, in every, like,
in every
know,
city,
every
like,
block.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, you know, you go like, yeah, you're going to scrape the bottom
like
the of the
ex-cons.
Barrel. Because what, like, how many just generally good-natured, kind old men are they that want kids to sit on their lap for hours upon hours? Like, yeah, for minimum wage, you very quickly get to the bottom of the barrel and that's America.
Yeah, no, we don't have, like, they're not in shopping malls, guys. They're in, like, there'll be little event things. It's like Santa's grotto, and then you can go and you can have a picture with Santa. And I did that as a child, but, yeah.
I'm
no,
sorry, what's a grotto?
Just is this like
the Willy Wonka experience?
Maybe.
What is a grotto?
That might be a thing now. Grotto, like, oh god, how do I describe a grotto? It's just like where Santa lives. That's kind of what we thought Santa lived, you know. He's just like a little
the North Pole, like Santa Land.
It's well, like a Santa experience.
Yeah, how does one describe a grotto? I've never had to describe a grotto.
Is it just
in
like
my life.
Santa's got like a little hut that he sits in front of with this big golden chair?
Yeah,
yeah,
it's
okay.
A hut and it's got
Santa. Well, like, do you get like hot chocolate or anything, or you just show up to his hut? Like,
no,
is it like
there.
An experience?
Then,
like, do you like go on a train ride?
I have a distinct memory of going to one and they gave us little gifts. So we'd get in the line and then we'd go over, we'd have our picture with Santa, and then he'd give us this like gift. And it was probably just like a coloring book or something. But we were like, oh yeah, we got a present from Santa. But
no, our kids do not get gifts from Santa. No. They ask for gifts and then it's up to
but
their
I
parents.
Want,
that's
crazy. I need to remind you that this was a long time ago. So they might have them in shopping malls now in the UK. We're becoming increasingly more like America.
This is what
we don't
happens.
Have shopping malls anymore.
Well, yeah,
so.
Our shopping malls are dead. This is what happens when you live in a country where like people pay taxes and you can give things to the greater good. Kids get coloring books. That's never going to come out of Mr. Macy's wallet.
But then I'm also wondering because I did a lot, like, I grew up a little bit in Germany, so maybe it's different there as well. I don't know whether, because I like my young years were in Germany, so
I bet Deutschland does a bit.
They love Christmas over there. The market,
yeah, I was gonna say, like, I know that they have, like, well, we call them German villages, I'm sure, and they're just villages in Germany, but like, we, like, in Baltimore, we have like recreated like German villages, and all of our like Christmas markets are like made to look like German villages and stuff, and like that is a very like wintry, Christmassy sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I just find it funny that we're talking about Christmas in March. really, really getting in the spirit before we reach December. Yeah, no, Santa, because here's the thing though, when the drunk Santa appeared, I knew exactly what was going on though. I was like, nah, drunk Santa. And I think that's because I see it in other things. I feel like that has happened in other
bad Santa.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are many movies that play on this.
The
show.
First, I think the first Christmas, the first Simpsons ever was like Homer plays like a drunk Santa.
like it's in Nathan For You, like, yeah. You know, Nathan finds like a mall Santa who's like a freak and like befriends him. And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's an ongoing trope. So that's interesting that like your recognition of that trope came from like other American media and not like personal experience.
Well, I've never met a drunk Santa. But...
I did. My family used to hire one to come to my grandma's house
all right.
for Christmas.
All right. Anyway, to be fair, we chose this movie in like November and we were like, we'll watch it soon. And then we, you know, we didn't. We watched it 2 days before we recorded. But yeah, luckily it's not, it's like, it's about Christmas and it's like, you know, the spirit of Christmas and stuff. But it's not like hit you over the head with it or something. You know, it's not like Miracle on 34th Street or something where it would really feel weird to watch it any other time. Like this was just like, yeah, sure. It's a Christmas movie.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, I actually want to give some credit and say like, I do think some of the themes of this movie are really like, are pretty strong. Like, I think I like the, you know, idea of like driving overnight for Christmas gifts. I like the theme of like, what would you do for your kids to have a great Christmas? You know, I like the idea that like, you know, you take your experiences as a child and then try to do better by your kids. Like, I think that those are genuinely strong themes. And I think because those themes are strong, there are genuinely tender moments that come out of them. Like, you know, her, you know, Lauren Graham's character, Luann, like, you know, wrapping up the bridge game for her son and then him going and knowing that she's going to hate it. And then by surprise, he loves it because he's just like his dad. Like, you know, I think that there are some really tender moments that come out of it because of those strong themes, but they are at like the dismay of like the people cast, which I don't dislike any of those people, but they're like total C-listers, you know? It's like they're at the dismay of the people cast, the actual writing, their bizarre leaning into like language that we did not use in 2014 as passively as they were doing in this movie. So like there are just like a lot of things that don't work about it, but I feel like the bones are there. I kind of wish that it had gotten in like better hands.
Yeah, one of the things for me with this is that I just don't feel like it utilized its cast particularly well, particularly Robin Williams. I felt like it was, and this is one of the films that came out after he had passed away, so it's one of those things where it's like people will have probably gone to see this like, oh, it's going to be this really nice Robin Williams film. We get to see him do his thing probably for, you know, one of the last times that we're going to see him in something new. And it just really didn't utilize him to his best of his ability. And I felt like with most of the cast, I mean, to be honest, I'm not particularly like knowledgeable on like Community, as you said, the guy from Community, and I haven't seen Gilmore Girls, so I don't know these other actors particularly well and what their capabilities are outside of this. But yeah, I did feel like there was, these actors weren't necessarily utilized in the best way that they could be. And I mean, the director of this is someone who's, when I was looking at his stuff, he directs loads of like TV comedy stuff. So he's directed Community, he's directed Brooklyn Nine-Nine, like he's done that sort of stuff. And this definitely felt like that. When I watched it, I felt like I was watching like a American sitcom. And so I don't know whether that necessarily didn't land particularly well for me as like a film. But I just felt like there just wasn't enough utilization of who they had in this cast. Because realistically, it's a story that we've seen stories like this done time and time again, like Christmas movies. They aren't necessarily reinventing the wheel, you know. We go in there expecting a certain thing and we want to just feel the joy of Christmas. And it had every potential to do that based on like the very basic structure of the story. But yeah, it just felt like the people weren't particularly utilized as well as they could have been.
Yeah, it's definitely a cast of people who like can do other things and are known for doing other things. Tim Heidecker fills out this cast. Wendy McClendon Covey fills out this cast. Candace Bergen. And I think Robin Williams especially, you know, I mean, the elephant in the room is, you know, this was towards the end of his life, right? He was getting sick. He was becoming increasingly sort of paranoid and anxious because he knew that this sickness was coming. And, you know, I don't know if this is the Robin Williams performance that people are going to remember him for. Right. And, when I watch Inside the Actor's Studio, James Lipton asks him at one point, do you know how many voices you do in Aladdin? And he goes like, probably 20, 30. And he goes, 57. Somebody count. It's 57. And, you know, Robin's eyes kind of get big and you go, oh, wow, 57. And, you know, I'm not going to diminish this guy's entire career to voices, but that was a serious thing that he did. You know, he would introduce himself to people in accents, right? Some people thought he was French for the first month that they knew him, because anytime he was around them, he would only speak with a French accent, you know, and playing these characters, you know, he does Mrs. Doubtfire. And obviously there's the old Scottish woman, Mrs. Doubtfire, but there's like all the prank phone calls he makes in that movie, like playing different characters and doing the voice of different characters is such a big part of what he does. Now in this old man, this haggard old alcoholic man, feels like a Robin Williams character. It feels like a guy he would slip into on stage or slip into it inside the Actor's Studio and riff for 20 seconds, and then he would turn into somebody else. And so watching him play one of these characters for like 73 minutes, I mean, the movie is very short. It definitely doesn't feel like him. He has a very like specific kind of charisma. You know, he's always got his smirks, you know, like he gives off a very distinct vibe, which is one reason people love him so much. And so when he's playing an unlikable character in like his stock company of the characters that lived inside of his body, and in a movie that isn't particularly funny, it just falls flat. And so like, okay, we wrapped this background to the beginning of our conversation, like, oh, I wanted to see how does a lowest rated movie come about. You know, we couldn't watch Toys because it wasn't available for you. Toys, you know, I think is different because people just really disliked that movie, you know, and it was a very divisive movie. Merry Friggin' Christmas, or whatever it's called for you, is just like a Merry Christmas Miracle, is just like a not very successful movie. It, you know, Toys was divisive and people loved it or they hated it. Merry Friggin' Christmas, I don't think there are a lot of people that have snuggled it alongside Bad Santa and Miracle on 34th Street in their holiday rotation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously a huge part of that is due to the writing. Like, these are characters that are not very well fleshed out. They care way more about trying to punch up jokes that aren't very successful to begin with. So that, you know, the writing just really falls flat. I feel like, you know, I really don't want to poo on, like, Joel McHale and Lauren Graham, because I think that, like, obviously they are iconic for, like, their television roles, like Lorelai Gilmore and oh my gosh, I can't even think of Joel McHale's character's name, and
Jeff
in Community. Like, they have successful careers. They pay the bills very easily. They are talented in their own right. Like, I'm not trying to poo on them. However, they are people who, like, take a paycheck. Like, they are not picky with what they do particularly. They don't really have the luxury to be extremely picky. So when this slides across their desks, they go like, okay, like, it makes sense that Joel McHale and Lauren Graham are in this, and that, like, they are not, you know, like, they are not acting too good for this. I almost feel like there were moments where, like, you could almost see Robin's, like, frustration with the script, and you could almost see, like, a frustration with, like, it just not being very effectively written. I almost feel like a lot of his lines were, like, thrown away and very, like, like, all the things that we praise him for in Good Will Hunting, like, being very, like, living in this character's body and reacting rather than acting. Like, I feel like he actually is doing the opposite at many points in this movie, and it almost feels like in rebellion. Like, I can't work with this script. I don't know if anyone else kind of clocked that.
Is that harsh? But
yeah, I'm kind
probably
of
a disappointment.
I'm exaggerating for the sake of making this point, but I do feel like he just seemed disappointed, and, like, you know, was just kind of throwing things away because of that.
I don't know. It's just kind of, like I said, it was just very middle of the road. Obviously, as you guys said, that we might have a different cut of the film, but it was very middle of the road. Just like. As I asked you before with Good Will Hunting, would you watch it again? For me, like, if we ask that question again here, this isn't something that I would necessarily watch again. We've ticked it off the list. It's another Robin Williams film watched, but in a way, I think it's almost a shame that this is one of the ones that it's his last, well, last few performances. I think it was one of three films that got released after his death. It's sort of a bit like, oh, well, that's a shame that that's one of the last ones. But I mean, we have all of the other stuff that he did that we can look back on, but you kind of wish that there had been a sort of more definitive end, I guess.
Yeah, there's, I echo everything you said, and this Inside the Actors Studio, it was like 2001, it was like summer 2001. And, you know, part of the thing that they do on this show is, you know, they talk about their new movie or their upcoming movie. And I just thought it was really funny that the last thing that he could address, and, you know, James Lipton had, he was very serious and had this kind of very presentational way about himself. The last thing he says, tell us about Death to Smoochie, which is a movie I've never seen. But I like the idea of, like, please tell us about Death to Smoochie.
And all the students are like, why are you wasting our time? They had to go to Blockbuster and rent it.
It's directed by Danny DeVito. I'm sure it was a big deal.
I'm sure. Yeah, I feel like in terms of, you know, you asking the question, like, would we watch this again? I mean, the short answer is no.
Well, I have.
Well, I mean, yeah, we have watched it again. But I feel like the long answer to that is, like, at least there, you know, we say this is distinctly American. I feel like you can say that positively and negatively. You can go, like, this is distinctly American. Like, I'm sick of these tropes not being in, and also not being effective. But then you go, like, this is distinctly American. Like, yeah, there is something, even though this is not a movie I grew up with and it is not nostalgic in that way, it is nostalgic in a way of, like, this is what movies felt like in 2014 or 2004, but who's counting? But, like, you know, it feels nostalgic in that way because we have, like, American experience to connect it to. Not saying I would reach for it again, but, like, I, when you were like, I wouldn't watch this again, I would be like, yeah, like, why would you? Like, at the very least, I could say, like, if I want to watch a shitty drunk mall Santa movie, I'll turn this on. Not that I do that.
I had
frequently.
Santa. Why would you ever?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, not that I would ever choose this one, but, like, there is something there. But yeah, I can totally see, Jess, why you are a hard no on that.
I like to imagine James Lipton and Robin Williams doing a show, wherever they're doing a show now, for all the acting students, wherever they are now, and him going, tell me about A Merry Friggin' Christmas.
Yeah. And that's when they all start zipping up their backpacks. In the way that teachers hate. It's not time to go yet. The bell dismisses you, not me.
No, sorry.
I dismiss you. The bell doesn't. Yeah, I feel like my kind of final thoughts on this is, like, you're right, or in terms of Robin in this, you're right. It feels like a character that he would do for 20 seconds, but then, like, that character is not sustainable. Even though this is only, like, a 76-minute movie, it's not even sustainable for those 76 minutes, and you just go, like, that paired with kind of a shitty script, paired with people who are, like, notorious for phoning it in. And again, no shade to Joel McHale and Lauren Graham. I think they are two
people. Joel McHale has never played a character in his life.
Yeah, like, I think that, you know, Joel put every bit of his creative ability into Community, and now that's just what he does, which I do think is just a version of himself. And I think Lauren Graham, you could say a similar thing about, like, Parenthood and Gilmore Girls. But yeah, she's very her. Like, they hire Joel McHale and Lauren Graham to stand in for people who are them, you know? And so I feel like it's a weird one. I feel like obviously there is that just, like, elephant in the room about it that makes it slightly unsettling to watch and kind of experience. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like it could be worse, but it's not very good. I gave it a 2.5 because I feel like you were saying, Jess, it feels just kind of like, albeit a little offensive, like bog standard. Like, you didn't do anything to really make this special in any way.
Yeah, I mean, we've touched quite a bit on his career and sort of the legacy that he's left behind. I'm curious as to what, for you guys, like, what are your favorite films of his?
Well, one thing this has sparked for me, and I tend to do this, but one thing that sparked for me is, like, I want to fill in a bunch of the holes. Like, I'm starting to go, I've never watched all of Good Morning Vietnam, and I started on a plane once and I never finished it. and I kind of want to watch Death to Smoochie now. Mm. And, you know, I don't know if I've, like, I don't think I've seen Aladdin since I was a kid. Like, I get really, kind of zoom out, you know. I will say we've mentioned it a couple times, but the thing that I'll throw out there is, for anybody that hasn't seen Dead Poets Society, and especially if you like Good Will Hunting, very similar thing. He's playing that mentor character again. He gets to do a little bit more of his comedy thing because he's like he's a teacher in front of a classroom. So he plays a lot of characters and he goes kind of over the top and stuff, but it really works for that. Yeah, I think that would probably be my pick.
Yeah, I know that this is so lame, but I feel like so many of his movies I have not seen since I was a child. Like, I have not seen Night at the Museum since I was a kid. I have not seen Mrs. Doubtfire since I was a kid. When it comes to something like Jumanji, okay, I watched Jumanji, you know, somewhat recently for the first time because I grew up with Zathura. So for me, Zathura is my preferred Jumanji-esque movie, other than the new Jumanji movies, which I'm obsessed with, and that's a whole side tangent that I'm not going to go on. So, like, yeah, I feel like just based on, like, recency bias alone, it's going to be Dead Poets Society for me because we just watched it. But I'm also going through his filmography and going, like, I want to watch more of these. I really feel like, you know, there are a lot here that are aligned. Like, you know, Flubber, I haven't seen since I was a kid. Not that that would be my favorite anyways. But, like, even though I watch these as a kid, I can't be like, man, Night at the Museum or Flubber, they're so nostalgic for me. Because I watched them one time at a sleepover and then that was it. Mrs. Doubtfire is probably the most nostalgic for me. If I had to think of, like, Robin Williams, like, I would probably think Mrs. Doubtfire.
For me, the nostalgic ones are Hook and Jumanji. I used to watch them all the time. I remember watching Jumanji with my brother and us being really scared by it at the beginning when he gets sucked into the board game. And then I kept watching. I don't think my brother did, but I kept watching it and I was just so, like, it was so entertaining for me as a kid and I've watched it so many times. I remember rewatching it at some point in my adult life and I was like, this still slaps. And I agree. I really like the new Jumanjis as well. He is one of those people, like, I go through his filmography and I'm like, there were huge gaps. Like, I hadn't seen Mrs. Doubtfire until I was an adult. Don't ask me why. I have no idea. My parents just never put that on, apparently. Which was wild to me, but, like, that was really fun when I watched that as an adult. Like, but it is one of those things where a lot of his stuff that I enjoy is more nostalgia based. I watched Insomnia today that he's in because I'm sneak preview, I'm doing a Christopher Nolan episode, and he was really good in that. But yeah, I would say that, like, in terms of nostalgia, I think my favorite ones are Hook and Jumanji. I actually think Robin Williams would be a really good one for your little a-thon series.
Yeah, maybe we'll consider it for season 4.
I've been trying to pitch Taylor a different perspective on season 4, so maybe not a bad idea. I will say real quick, I do want to shout out Aladdin. I think it's kind of easy to be like, oh, it's the Disney movie, and there are a lot of things about Aladdin that work that aren't Robin Williams, but he plays 57 characters in that movie and he's brilliant, and they had like 18 hours of tape that they could use for him, and they kind of molded his performance out of that because he would just riff for days and days and days. And also there's a moment in the Inside the Actor's Studio where somebody says, what is your role? What is the Robin Williams role? And he says, I think I'm still looking for it. He kind of gives that kind of actory answer. But I will say, when James Lipton mentions Aladdin, there is this kind of special twinkle in his eye and he kind of sits up a little bit. And I think that maybe secretly that was the Robin Williams role, because that was just everything that he was good at. And they gave him free rein. And I think that kind of, and also just being a kids movie that people passed down to their generations and stuff. And I think it's definitely probably the most kind of synonymous with his style.
I also, okay, no one asked for this, but I find a way to move this documentary into any conversation that I ever have. If you loved Aladdin as a kid and you particularly are interested in, like, voice work and Robin Williams voice work, there is a really tremendous documentary called Life Animated that I recommend to everyone. I think we've talked about it, like, multiple times across our podcast, or, like, I've mentioned it multiple times across our podcast. It's just spectacular. It's about a boy with autism who learns to speak through character voices, most notably in Aladdin, and how, and it talks about just like, what is a voice? Like, what does voice mean? How can voice be created? And they kind of hone in on Gilbert Gottfried, who made himself available for the filming of that documentary and like comes to speak to the family and stuff. But they talk a lot, like Aladdin is basically like, he just started communicating in like phrases and quotes from that movie and a couple other movies. And I feel like if you are a huge fan of that kind of like work that Robin Williams does, you just might appreciate it. And I feel like it is like a critically underseen documentary that I like love.
I have to add that to the list. That sounds really cool. So we have to ask, I mean, I feel like we've already answered this question already, but I have to ask, because that's the whole point of the podcast. Which film did you prefer?
1 hour photo.
Yes.
Dead Poets Society. No. Yeah. Good Will Hunting.
For me, my favorite obviously was Good Will Hunting of the two. So yeah, that is our Robin Williams episode wrapped up. Obviously, really, I thought it was a really cool discussion and a really good suggestion from you, Patrick. Because yeah, I don't know why he wasn't on my list, but I'm glad that we got to talk about him. Do you guys want to just reel off your social media and where we can find you and what you've been up to?
Yeah, thank you for first of all, thank you for having us on and for giving me an outlet to. Think about these things that I think about in terms of like what would be a good podcast topic. You can find us at our website, which is futurepresentationvideo.com, and it's the home of everything that we do. Right now we're doing the Wes Anderson-a-thon. It's the season 3 of our filmography exploration podcast. We're watching every single Wes Anderson movie. We are talking about the movies that inspired it, the movies that they inspired. We do lots of fun stuff on our website, stuff 5 days a week over there, written reviews, podcasts, recommendations, watch lists, recurring columns. We have some fun guest writers and stuff. So head on over to our website. That's where you can find all of our socials and stuff. Futurepresentationvideo.com. It is the home of everything that we do.
So you can find the socials for this podcast. We're at Better Bad Pod across all social platforms. You can follow me on Instagram at Jess Rolland and me on Twitter as well at Jess_Rolland. You can also follow my social media for my short film at Heat Short Film if you want to keep up to date with everything that's going on with that. Cool. I will wrap this up here. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time on Better Than Bad. Join me next time on Better Than Bad, where I'll be discussing David Tennant's highest and lowest rated films. We'll be talking about United and Centurions 2, The Legend of Fritton's Gold. See you then.